And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, May 30th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests today are Christina Lynch and Alexandria Marzano-Leskovich. First up is Christina Lynch. She's a novelist, television writer, and professor. A former Milan correspondent for W and Women's Wear Daily, she has written on staff for television shows such as The Dead Zone, Encore, Encore, Unhappily Ever After, and Wildfire. A devoted educator, she's taught television writing for UCLA Extension and is a full-time tenure-track professor of English at College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California, where she is also faculty advisor for the literary magazine there. She lives in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, and The Italian Party is her debut novel and the focus of her conversation today. Hi, Christina.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Great to have you. Let's begin by talking about The Italian Party and how the novel came about.
Well, I finished my MFA degree in the summer of 2013 and thought, okay, it's time to start that big project. And I thought, well, what book doesn't exist but I would really want to read? And that was just sort of the impetus for it. I love Italy, so that was at the top of the list. And horses and dogs and the Palio horse race. And lots of good food, but then some intrigue. And I lived there for 7 years and I was in my 20s at the time. And now I'm a little bit ashamed of what I didn't know about American involvement in Italy. So that was something that I wanted to include. So that was sort of what got the ball rolling.
So did the novel actually take root there? I mean, back then, did you know someday you would be, you know, writing a novel or writing short stories and wanting to fictionalize the place? Or was it more a sort of living it, experiencing it, and then later going, uh-oh?
You know, I was really living it. I was doing some fiction writing at the time, nothing that was ever published. But I was working as a journalist, so that was really where most of my writing energy was going. And I knew that I would someday want to write about it. And I'm a little surprised it took that long, actually. I guess the timing was right at last to sort of look back at my time there. Not that the novel is not at all a memoir, but sort of digest it and think about how to put that into fiction.
So. Yeah. Some things take time, right? And writers are very, very short on patience.
It's true. And something as big as, you know, your relationship with a country, it takes a while to, when you're away from it, to really think about it and digest it, which is one of the themes of the book that, you know, you don't really know what it means to be an American until you're living outside the country.
Well, talk about setting the Italian Party in 1956. Why did you choose this year?
So I knew that I wanted to set it in the 50s. My parents were newlyweds when they set off for South America in the 50s, which is always interesting to me, but they're not around for me to ask about that. And then I was in my 20s when I was 22 when I moved to Italy and not really knowing the language and not that familiar with the culture. So I didn't want to do their experience. I didn't want to do my experience. But I thought the 50s was a really interesting time. So I started doing some reading. And one of the books that I read was Legacy of Ashes, which is a history of the CIA. And in reading that book, I started to zero in on the middle 50s and the fact that communists were increasing in political power and elected offices in Italy and what the American reaction to that was. I was interested in the time when Clare Boothe Luce was our ambassador to Italy, and she was America's first female ambassador. So I started to get closer and closer. And then 1956, I landed on that particular summer at the beginning of 1956, Khrushchev denounced Stalin. And everyone in the U.S. sort of wondered, what would that mean? It was a time of really great uncertainty in the Cold War, because they didn't know if that would mean the end of the Cold War or would it get colder? And then by the end of that year, they had their answer when there was the Hungarian uprising that was very brutally put down by the Soviets. And that action really fragmented the Italian left, which was a relief to the U.S. But it just became a really interesting summer in Italy, and the idea of an American who was sent there on a Cold War mission. So.
Well, there's a lot of secrets going on in this book. A lot's going on in this book, but especially the secrets, and the characters have secrets, and one of which could land Michael, who is a government employee, in jail. And talk about that a little bit, and perhaps sort of, I don't know, unfolding these characters' stories and how much you knew before going in and how much developed as you were writing.
The thing that really developed while I was writing it was when to reveal these secrets to the reader and to Scotty and Michael, to learn each other's secrets. And that was the trickiest part. I think I did 20 drafts of this book. I don't mind too much with the spoiler alerts, because as it is in the final version, the reader learns everything up front. Mm-hmm. And then the fun is in seeing how the two characters learn each other's secrets and what their reactions are. We learn in the first few pages, Michael and Scotty are newlyweds, arriving in Italy in 1956. He is ostensibly there to sell Ford tractors, and she is sort of the perfect 1950s expatriate wife, going along to make a nice house for him. But the main secrets they're keeping from each other is that Michael is actually working for the CIA, which she is not aware of. And his mission is there. He's there to throw an election, a mayoral election in Siena. Michael does not know that Scotty is pregnant with another man's child. And her marriage to Michael was really out of desperation. And Scotty doesn't know that Michael is gay. And at the time, it was illegal, as you were saying, it was illegal to be a government employee and be gay. So those are pretty massive secrets they're keeping from each other. And then the fun is in seeing how those secrets come out and what, as I said, what their reactions are.
Well, the novel starts out quite sunnily. They're this young American couple driving down the road in a big yellow car, I think it is, and
yes.
And then it sort of quickly starts turning shades darker, which is interesting. Talk about that, and I'm always interested if how much writers know. I mean, we talked a little bit about that, but how surprised perhaps you were to see what was happening or how it was going to happen with them, or are you a plotter and you just knew on page whatever that this was going to happen?
I'm not a plotter at the beginning, although I'm a big fan of the reverse outline, which is you write for a few hundred pages and then you do an outline of what you have. And see, does this make sense? The tone here was tricky, because I did want to write something light. And I will say, when I started writing, I thought the whole novel would be very light and very funny. And then, as you're noting, when I started writing these characters and really exploring their issues and the problems of the time and what drove them to keep these secrets from each other and the emotional pain behind that, the novel did take on more layers, which ultimately I'm really happy about. But it was tricky to kind of keep, not do an abrupt switch, to keep some of the lightness throughout. And I was really thinking about movies like Roman Holiday and our view of Italy in the 1950s, but wanting to go deeper and, you know, take that beautiful picture of fun and two people on a scooter, but then really zoom into their heads and look at what was really happening in their personal lives in the country itself. So to go below that beautiful surface, which I think a lot of Americans want to stop there with Italy. And I think we do the country a disservice when we just treat it like our resort, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's a beautiful place, and it's a wonderful place to vacation. But, you know, as we're seeing this week, this is a country with, you know, its own set of political issues then and now. So,
yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Christina Lynch. Her new novel is The Italian Party, published by St. Martin's Press. So, you know, speaking of tone and your book, somewhere I read where it was compared to Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley, I think it was. And I wondered what you thought of that comparison and if you liked it.
Well, thrilled, yes.
I know, I love that book, too.
Yes, that's an amazing book. That's a different tone, and of course, that book was written in that era. But it's, you know, it's wonderful to be compared to, you know, a classic like that. I think hers is a little darker throughout. It's similar in that she's going beneath the surface of that, you know, beautiful, in her, the seacoast in Italy in the 50s. A much darker book than this one, for sure. So.
Well, I would love to hear you read from The Italian Party.
I would be delighted to.
Okay.
So I'm just going to pick up right after the beginning. So as you said, Michael and Scotty, it's April of 1956, and they are driving through Italy for the first time in a very large Ford Fairlane. So I'm going to pick up just after that beginning. Michael and Scotty stood out from the moment they strolled down the gangplank of the sleek ocean liner that carried them and their possessions to Italy. They seemed to have stepped right out of an advertisement for Betty Crocker, Wonder Bread, or capitalism itself. He was 24, handsome, always in a nicely cut suit, camera around his neck. She, barely 20, was a knockout. Blonde, pretty, quick to laugh, always in an elegant hat and pearl choker. She had what the Italians call raffinatezza, a word that covers everything that is the opposite of vulgar, a quality Italians deeply aspired to, while at the same time remaining powerless to resist anything gilded, mirrored, shiny, or bejeweled. This spring, the papers were full of the marriage of Grace Kelly and Prince Rainier, and it was as if Sienna's own version of the royal couple had arrived. Even though there were other Americans coming and going in Sienna, those two would become the Americans, gli Americani, both of them so young, healthy, wealthy, and in love. They seemed so free. That was how they seemed. They were arriving in Siena as part of a wave of missionaries bringing the American way of life to what they were certain would be a grateful populace. Michael felt like he'd won the lottery. This beautiful creature had agreed to marry him and come on a foreign adventure. A Vassar girl from a good family out in California. Him just a boy from the Bronx. And the best part was, she wasn't that smart. Because that's what Michael wanted, what he needed, someone who wasn't too curious, someone who would mistake his version of things for the truth. The Italians would take them at face value, see only what they were meant to see. As a culture, the Italians valued furbizia, slyness, more than honesty, but they would not expect to find it in Americans, who were generally seen as genial idiots ripe for the plucking. It was only natural for Michael and Scotty to make assumptions about each other, too. They had known each other just a short time, and no courtship is entirely honest. It was convenient for Michael that Scotty had been taught that asking questions, as long as they were not too personal or impertinent, rather than offering opinions, made a man feel he was being listened to and supported. She had been taught that a woman likes to feel beautiful and a man likes to feel superior. That was what she had been taught. That was what he believed she had learned.
Interesting. Thank you so much. That was Christina Lynch reading from The Italian Party. You know, as you were reading that section, I was thinking about, Scotty and Michael's secrets from each other and how it's a bit different today, I think. I mean, I don't know if prenuptials were a part of things back then. I'm kind of thinking not. But how, if you had based this story today, could this still play out in a similar way?
I don't know in that these particular secrets you would keep from each other in sort of, mainstream American culture. But I do think that we say no courtship is entirely honest, and I think that is true. And I'm sorry to say that there are cult subcultures in the U.S. where people are still hiding that they're gay, and also, that you wouldn't necessarily be honest if you were pregnant. So I think in our ideal version of our current culture, no, you wouldn't feel the need to keep these secrets from each other. But I think in reality, people are still keeping plenty of secrets.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
When we started out this morning, you said something to the effect of you wanted to write the sort of book that you wanted to read. And so I was thinking about genre and if you took it that far. I looked at the copyright page and The Italian Party is listed as family secrets as regards to married people. And it's also, I think, listed as black humor in terms of literature. And it's also been called a thriller, and it's been talked about in different ways by different people, different reviewers. How would you categorize it?
Ooh, that's actually a really hard question. I think it's all those things, which I do think makes it a little harder for it to find an audience. I think there's a lot of people out there who would love it, who might look at the cover and think like, oh, it's just a fluffy book. And there's people who are looking for a fluffy book who might think, wow, this is actually a lot darker than I expected.
Readers
enjoy the fact that it doesn't cue to one genre.
Yeah.
That it does, I love genre fiction, but it isn't always surprising, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to do in this book was for you to be turning the pages because you didn't know. You sense as a reader that it is falling outside the rules of the genre, which means the rules are off and you don't know what's going to happen to these people.
Speaking of the cover, I didn't think it was a fluffy read before I cracked the spine because it's black and white and the mm-hmm. Italian Party is in red, is in a red box. And the man in the picture, half his head is cut off and the woman, the top of her head. So that it feels like something's a little off, a little hidden, there's some sort of mystery going on. So
that's great.
Yeah.
You read that image exactly as I hoped you would.
Oh, good.
Yeah, the title is a double entendre. It's what people see of Italy is it's a party. But the Italian Party in this case also refers to the Italian Communist Party. And the role that they played in Italy in the 50s. And, what they aspired to, which was a society that didn't have massive inequality.
Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about sort of the business of writing and teaching writing. And I always ask professors, I'm always curious how they teach writing and if you think you can teach someone to be a writer, or if it's something you help someone develop or help it to bloom, if your role is to water the seeds of that ability.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think even students wonder themselves about, you know, is this something I teach both composition, and then as you mentioned, I'm a faculty advisor for the Creative Writing Club, and I'll finally be actually teaching creative writing this coming academic year at College of the Sequoias. I have a lot of students who say, I can't write, and I have to kind of tease them out of that idea, because we can all write. If you can think, you can write. But as far as writing fiction, I think if you grow up reading a lot, it does come more easily. But there's a quality of being an observer that needs to be nurtured, I think. So can fiction writing be taught? I think to a certain extent, yes. But I also think that there is some kind of crazy innate desire to tell stories that they're probably going to eventually isolate on the genome. Because that to me seems like the thing that's different, right? That there are people who feel really compelled to tell, you know, to make up stories and tell them. Most of us want to tell our own story. But there's a sort of subgroup of people like me who want to make up stories and tell them to entertain other people. And it seems very primal to me. It does feel like, I mean, I'm joking about isolating it on the genome, but I do think that it is something in us.
Yeah. Well, and you had said at the beginning of the show that when you got your MFA and were out of the program, it was time to write the novel. And I hear from a lot of writers who go into the MFA program at various colleges and universities that they're discouraged from writing novels, that it's very much a place where you work on short stories. Is that what you found too?
Yes. I think it's the nature of the program. I did my MFA at Antioch in LA, which I love the program, wonderful people. But you are changing mentors, you know, every semester. So I think it would be hard to, people do work on novels during an MFA. I think it would be tricky because you'd be getting, it would be as if you were changing, you know, your editor every 6 months. So I think that would be difficult to sustain a longer project. So it makes sense to work on short fiction during the MFA program and then kind of dive into something that takes years to finish.
Yeah,
when you're done. Yeah.
Well, I can't believe we're at the end of our time. I wonder if
I know. I'd love to keep talking.
I know. Maybe when you're down this way, we can have you at the speaker series in Newport Beach. Maybe do that.
I would be delighted
sometime.
To do that.
Could be a lot of fun. In closing, though, do you have any advice or last words for the novelists listening?
Yes. Keep writing. Find each other. I think a big part of working on longer fiction today is to find each other and sustain each other. I have a group of writer friends who sustained me through the 5 years of, you know, from starting this novel to when it came out this spring. And I really encourage writers to find each other and read each other's work and be generous and supportive with each other. So.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because it's nothing going on writing in a vacuum.
No. And I think it's harder on the writer, too. You know, if you write 500 pages and you hand it to someone and they say, huh, you know, that's crushing. But if you write 20 pages and you give it to someone and they say, ooh, this is great, I'm really responding to this, you know, then you're developing a relationship with readers. And if you can do that with five or six different people, then you're developing your own sense of what the response to your work is along the way. And that doesn't mean you're not being true to your own voice. It means you're being true in connecting to readers using your voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Good place to end with that thought. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for supporting writers.
Oh, you're welcome. That was Christina Lynch. Her new novel is The Italian Party, published by St. Martin's Press. Stay with us. Our next guest is Alexandria Marzano Leskovich. Please stay tuned.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. And one way you can hear the podcast of this show when it's put up there, and all the other shows, hundreds actually, is to go to iTunes and search out the podcast Writers on Writing. When we upload the show, this episode and others will fall into your podcast file, and you'll be able to hear it at any time. I also need to say that the opinions and views you hear on this show are my views and the views of my guests, and not those of the University of California Regents. My next guest is Alexandria Marzano Leskovich. Alexandria is the author of The Fact of a Body, a murder and a memoir, named one of the best books of the year by Entertainment Weekly, Audible.com, Bustle, Book Riot, The Times of London, and The Guardian. An Indie Next pick and a Junior Library Guild selection, it was longlisted for the Gordon Byrne Prize and a finalist for a New England Book Award, a Goodreads Choice Award, and a Lambda Literary Award. Alexandria has received fellowships from the National Endowment of the Arts, McDowell, and Yaddo, as well as a Rona Jaffe Award. She lives in Boston, where she teaches at Harvard, and as I said, her book is The Fact of a Body, a Murder and a Memoir, published by Flatiron. And that's the focus of our conversation this morning. Hi, Alexandria.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you. Great to have you. Let's start with the memoir and how it came to be.
Sure. It came to be because, as with so many other memoirists, I just had no choice but to write about this. It just kept bubbling up inside me. What happened was that when I was a law student at Harvard, I took a job helping to defend men accused of murder, men who faced the death penalty. And that was what I had gone to law school for. That was what I wanted to spend my life doing. I remember the moment when I learned about the death penalty as a child. From that moment, I had wanted to work against it. But when I got there, when I got to this law office, the very first thing that happened was that I was shown the confession videotape of a man named Ricky Langley, the man whose story is kind of at the heart of this book and entwined with my own. And on that confession videotape, he described killing a little boy named Jeremy Guillory, and he described the pleasure he took in molesting children. And in that moment, I was 25 years old, sitting there watching this. And even though I was 25 in that moment, as I watched him, I was suddenly a child again. And I could feel my grandfather's hands on me because I had grown up being molested. And in that moment, despite what I believed, despite what I wanted to fight for, I wanted Ricky Langley to die. But the very next thing that happened was that I learned that Jeremy Guillory's mother, the boy that Ricky Langley killed, his mother, his name was Lorelei Guillory. At the trial, she actually testified for Ricky Langley. She fought to keep her son's killer alive. And so this created all these collisions inside me. You can imagine that the first and most immediate one was, how has she been able to do that when I couldn't? What was there hidden in this story that I didn't know about? But then the second, the one that kind of sent me deep into my own past, is who we are determined by what we believe, or is who we are determined by the memories we carry, determined by what has happened in our past. And kind of over the years, I never stopped thinking about the case. I didn't become a lawyer, but I never stopped thinking about the case. And many years later, it sent me back into sort of reinvestigating it, but really also into reinvestigating my own life.
So you're 25, you are... at this law firm, you're learning about Ricky Langley. At that point, did you feel a book brewing inside, or at that point were you just so involved in the work that it took all of your mind space?
I did not feel a book brewing inside, not at all. I had certainly grown up writing. My high school yearbook is full of people signing, saying, I can't wait to buy your first book. Mm-hmm. I haven't followed up and asked if they did, but I hope they did. And so I had always written fiction. And then I kind of quit cold turkey when my grandfather passed away. And then I wouldn't have been able to name why at the time. But in retrospect, I think I was afraid that I would write about what had happened. And then this summer, when I was in Louisiana, I started writing fiction again. I started writing short stories that had absolutely nothing to do with the law firm or the case or anything like that. It's more just that I was having all these emotions that I couldn't articulate and I couldn't name. And the way I had always dealt with them was through fiction. So I was writing short stories that had,
nothing on the surface to do with anything. And that sent me back into fiction writing classes, and I enrolled in an MFA program after, after doing my law degree, after finishing my law degree, because I wanted to write fiction, and I was working on a novel, and so I enrolled in it for fiction. It wasn't until much later that I accepted that I was actually going to write this hybrid book instead.
That actually is one of my questions regarding a hybrid memoir, because I had a guest on last year who's a memoirist, and she talked about how these days hybrid memoirs are the way to go. And I don't know if that's when you started thinking of memoir, if you started thinking of it as being a hybrid and how it would perhaps be more interesting or more substantial, or exactly what you thought at that point. Can you track back and kind of talk about your entrance into the genre and how you saw the book in terms of the two threads and the story of the crime and your story interweaving?
Absolutely. So it was not that strategic on my part, I will say. What really happened was that I was writing fiction, and some of the details from the case kept bubbling up. And every time they appeared in a story, I would think, oh, that's from that case. But in those years, I couldn't remember Vicky Langley's name. I could remember everything else about the case, but I couldn't remember his name. It was like this perfect little pinprick excision in my mind. And there's only one other such moment in my life, and that moment has to do with my grandfather, where there's this perfect little pinprick excision. And so I thought then, okay, I'm going to get the court records, but I'm going to get them not to write about it. I'm going to get them to kind of put this story down. I was still just trying to write fiction that I thought had nothing to do with this. And so I got the court records and immediately realized that they were full of other people interpreting the case through the lens of their own past, just as I had with my own. And that sort of what I had thought was just a sort of a flaw in how I was wired emotionally, maybe actually had something to do with the way we understand each other and what happens in the law and the way we understand our own lives and how the law makes a story, and it's made up of the stories of the people who come into contact with the different crimes. So I decided to sort of write nonfiction about that. And my initial impulse was not to write memoir. It was to write a more journalistic, a straightforward journalistic recounting. The problem was that as I wrote, memoir kept bubbling into it. And then I would think, okay, what I'll do is I'll write a more straightforward memoir. But as I wrote, Ricky Langley's story would keep popping into it. And so I arrived at the hybrid genre pretty organically. And one of the first books I read that made me realize that memoir could actually do both things was a book by Michael Gilmore called Shot in the Heart. His brother, Gary Gilmore, was the first person executed when the U.S. reinstated the death penalty in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And Gary Gilmore asked to be executed by being shot in the heart. A bit of trivia that many people don't know, but that always strikes me as odd, is that the Nike slogan, "Just Do It," actually comes from Gary Gilmore's last words. Mm. The copywriter was apparently at his desk the following morning and saw the newspaper article, and that's where the slogan comes from. Yeah. But so that's just a side note. I have this mug that says creative nonfiction because you can't make this stuff up. And there are always details that kind of make me think of that mug. But so I sort of reluctantly, I read that book, and in that book, you know, Michael Gilmore recounts not only growing up in Utah, but he goes into sort of the history of Utah and the violence kind of built into the state's founding and the legacy of violence. And he also interweaves it with these ghost stories. And he takes ghosts, you know, I don't happen to believe in ghosts, but he takes ghosts, I don't think he does either, but he takes ghosts quite literally in the text and uses these hauntings to think about the way his family was haunted. So the book becomes this odd mix of history, mythology, and memoir. It's quite riveting. And I read that early on and thought, wait, you can do that? Nonfiction can do that? And that and many other books kind of made me start to think about what was possible. And then many years later, like I said, I actually realized that I was going to be writing this hybrid thing.
Interesting. Well, I'd love to hear you read from the book. I have so much more to talk to you about, but a little section would be great.
Absolutely. I'm just going to read from the start of chapter one.
Okay.
Louisiana, 1992. The boy wears sweatpants the color of a Louisiana lake. Later, the police report will note them as blue, though in every description his mother gives thereafter, she will always insist on calling them aqua or teal. On his feet are the muddy hiking boots every boy wears in this part of the state, perfect for playing in the woods. In one small fist, he grips a BB gun half as tall as he is. The BB gun is the Daisy brand. With a long brown plastic barrel, the boy keeps it shiny as if it were real metal. The only child of a single mother, Jeremy Guillory is used to moving often, sleeping in bedrooms that aren't his. His mother's friends all rent houses along the same dead-end street the landlord calls Watson Road whenever he wants to charge higher rent. Though it doesn't really have a name, and even the town police department will need directions to find it. Settlers from Iowa name the town after their home state, but wanting a fresh start, pronounce the name Iowa, even as they kept the spelling. The town has always been a place people come for new starts, always been a place they can't quite leave the past behind. There, the boy and his mother stay with whoever can pay the electricity bill one month, whoever can keep the gas on the next. Wherever the boy lands, he takes his BB gun with him. It is his most prized possession. Now it is the first week in February. The leaves are green and lush on the trees, but the temperature dips at night. Lorelei, Jeremy's mother, isn't working. She rented a home just for the two of them, their first, but the electricity has been turned off. Her brother, Richard, lives in a sprawling house up on the hill, but she's not staying with Richard. Instead, Lorelei and Jeremy are staying with Lorelei's friend, Melissa, Melissa's boyfriend, Michael, and their baby. The baby is 2 years old enough that he wants to play with the boy, and he screams when he doesn't get his way. Today, the baby is wailing. Jeremy, 6 years old, just off the yellow school bus home from kindergarten, eats his after-school snack in a hurry, dreaming of getting away from the noise, dreaming of the fun to be had out in the woods. At the end of the road, there is a weathered white house, and behind it, a thatch of woods. The woods are the dense, deciduous, swampy kind, the kind in which rotting leaves mingle with the earth and the ground gives soft way beneath the boy's feet. Though the thatch is very small, with only a single ravine like a scar in the earth, a single place to play war or dream of hiding away forever, these woods are Jeremy's favorite place to play. He asks his mother for the BB gun. She takes it down from the shelf that keeps it safe from the baby, and she hands it to him. Jeremy runs out the door. Two children near his age, a boy named Joey and a girl named June, live in the white house by the woods, and though Jeremy likes exploring on his own, it's more fun when Joey can join him. He goes to their door and he knocks. A man answers. I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you so much. That was Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich reading from The Fact of a Body, a Murder, and a Memoir, published by Flatiron. Throughout the book, I really like how you write about what you couldn't know. You know, like, for instance, on page 39, it begins with the house dress I have borrowed for Bessie in the scene, da-da-da, and you go on to describe that house dress. Of course, you don't know what that would have been, but you do it so effectively, and you solve a problem that I think memoirs have all the time, at least a problem I hear about all the time, and that is, but I don't remember, or I wasn't there, or how can I write about it if I don't know? Can you talk about doing that and how you found your way into using that technique?
Absolutely. Well, what happens when I try to write the book as straightforward journalism is that all these court records I was working from, and ultimately I worked off of 30,000 pages of court records about the Langley case that I spent years tracking down in rural Louisiana. I was working off of them, and what was coming out was kind of flat because the court records were missing, in some ways, everything that mattered. You know, the color, the texture, the images, the visuals, everything that makes memory so vivid and the emotions that live inside memory so resonant. memory always feels like it's unfolding in the present tense. It's always three-dimensional. It always has color and texture and sound senses. I realized that I was going to have to write in a way that imbued the records with as much vitality as my own memories had. And yet there were so many holes in both of them. There was so much, you know, that I didn't remember and didn't feel solid about. And there was so much in the records that was just missing. So I realized that what would happen was that when I read the records, I would kind of fill them in with images from my own life or textures or colors from how I imagined it. So, for example, that dress you just referenced, the dress I say on Bessie, I go on, you know, I give the reader a solid image in that moment of what that house dress looks like. But then a few pages later, I tell them, you know, that dress isn't in any records, but it is the dress I remember my grandmother wearing. And that for me, these two women are linked, and my memory is sort of layered over the court record. And what I realized I would have to do was just be really straightforward about that. So the narrator in this book, the storyteller, is very present. You're sort of always aware that she's telling herself the story off the records and from her own memories. And once I realized that that would be the device, the book really opened up for me. It kind of, the pages kind of started to fly together because I was able to imbue them with the lived experience of how this story was occurring to me, how the story was coming together for me. And so with my own memories, it was somewhat easier because I do remember so much of what happened. But the records, there were a lot of absences. And what I did was try to fill them in via research. And then when I couldn't fill them in via research, so I was very careful not to invent anything that happened, right? And not to make anything worse or anything like that. It was more just I was putting together all sorts of records to try to understand how I could fill in that story, what had happened, what sources I had. I have a source note section at the back of the book that kind of explains where everything comes from. But really, it was realizing that narrator. And there's this beautiful book by Delphine de Vigan called Nothing Holds Back the Night, the French author. And the book was published with a subheading, you know, a novel, but it's really a memoir, and she's quite open about that. And it opens with an image of her discovering her mother, Blue. Her mother had committed suicide. And she sort of discovers her mother dead, and she describes her mother's face, Blue. And there's a beautiful line at the end of that section that says, "And then, like many memoirs before me, I began to write my mother." And you turn the page, and her mother is a child again on the page for all these scenes that Delphine was never there for, but is imagining based off of what she does know, what she's been able to research, what she's been able to put together. And that book, too, was one that influenced me profoundly because I saw that you could create a dream for the reader and yet still be straightforward with the reader about where that dream was coming from and the way that it had been constructed and what you actually knew and what you didn't. That, in fact, the chasing after what you don't know is part of the story and is part of the emotional importance of the story and the emotional urgency. And that sort of, for me, what I realized is that far from being kind of a flaw, that it was actually a crucial part of the book, that I include that chasing.
Yeah, I love it. I it's so effective. It's it works so well. And the voice, you know, the voice is just wonderful. And, you know, I was thinking of something Mary Carr and actually Susan Orlean as well said. They said that a memoir should take on the speaking voice of the writer. And I wondered what you thought about that and if this would be your speaking voice.
I wish I were this eloquent in real life. you know, it took a lot of drafts to fine-tune that voice. I always think about, you know, I teach voice when I teach writing, and I give the students this excerpt from Orlean in which she talks about, you know, you just need to strip away everything else and access your one true voice. And we sort of laugh about it because it's so true, and it's also so impossible to follow, because if you try to strip everything away, in my experience, you end up with drafts that sound like anybody could have written them. So for me, it was more to think of the range of authentic voices to a writer that a writer has, and to think of constructing a voice that suits everywhere the book needs to go. So when I was initially writing this, the memories from my past would come out in this sort of lyrical voice, but the courtroom scenes, for example, that take place later in the book, would come out really pedantically and sort of really beholden too much to the records in this flat-toned newspaper voice. And I eventually realized that what I had to do was invent a voice that would be able to scale both of those and would incorporate both of those modalities and maybe wouldn't go to quite the extreme for either one of them, that I would write ultimately essays and journalistic pieces that were in the two extremes of the voices, but that the voice in the book had to kind of have this modulation and range to it. And so it almost had to be invented to suit this material. Another thing was that it had to be in present tense. I never write in the present tense. I can't believe I wrote a book in the present tense. And so as I present tense, it goes so flat so easily. But I realized that it had to be in present tense because memory is always in present tense. And because when you write in past tense, it has this declarative nature to it where it's like, this happened. I am pinning the past, mm-hmm. you know, to the wall. I'm sort of sticking a pin through the butterfly. And that's emphatically not what this book is doing. This book is about the slipperiness of the past. So, and the slipperiness of memory. So it had to be in present tense. So it was more about really constructing something, and that meant writing a lot of terrible drafts in which the voice went flat, but paying attention to where a line was right, a paragraph was right. I could feel it. And asking myself kind of who that storyteller was and what those sections had in common. And I'll always be grateful to a mentor of mine who, in my MFA program, you know, I had written this essay that had nothing to do with this. I wasn't doing the project of this book yet. And I remember that I got a copy of that essay back from him, and he had underlined this one sentence, and he was like, "This is an Alexandria Marzano Lesnovich sentence. What you're doing here, the rhythm. Like, I would know this sentence anywhere." When I read it back over, I could feel it. He was right. That sentence had this electricity to it that the stuff around it didn't. And that was the first time sort of that I understood that about my own work, that I would write a draft in which there were many wrong sentences, and then there would be somewhere where I did tap into the voice of the piece, my own voice and the voice of the piece. And that across pieces, there would be some commonality to that voice, but I would also be constructing a voice that suited that piece, that storyteller, the narrator who, in Vivian Gornick's terms, in The Situation and the Story, in a great craft book called The Situation and the Story, that storyteller who lives only to serve the subject matter at hand in this book. So it was really a process, I guess, of tapping into her voice.
What a treasure to have a mentor do that for you, huh?
Oh, it was beautiful. His name is Richard Hoffman. He's a poet, a short story writer, and a beautiful memoirist.
Mm. Well, I'm so sad that we're at the end of our time. I love the book. I listened to it and I read it. I listened to it on Overdrive, So you're reading it, and it's lovely to listen to. And then I have the print version as well, and I'm really glad I was able to hear you read some of it before I picked up the print version. It just kind of put me in your voice. And anyway, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This was just a lovely conversation.
Oh, you're welcome. That was Alexandria Marzano Lesnovich. Her book is The Fact of a Body. Loved it. One of my favorite memoirs of recent times. But that's all we have today. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and stay tuned. We're on 24/7 here at KUCI, and I think Marie will be back here next week, or maybe Nicole, or maybe both of them. In any case, have a great week, and remember to stay in the chair.